Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which can be on an iPod or on a computer or whatever device you listen to these things on. Point is, you don't have to be at a live show. Today we have an excellent show, as we have three different perspectives to ask questions on the cost shifting in electronic discovery. And one of the biggest problems of electronic discovery is, of course, the cost to comply with discovery requests. This issue can become especially acute when the parties have asymmetrical amounts of ESI. How these costs are borne is an issue which has vexed the parties and courts, and a number of opinions have tackled this issue head-on, such as one of the Zubelake opinions and a number of the opinions from Judge Francis, who's on the show here. But, of course, this issue isn't entirely new. Back in the days of paper, plaintiffs used to complain about having to search their warehouses of paper to find evidence. So I guess cost is something we've always had to deal with discovery. Today on our panel, I'm pleased to say we've got Judge Francis, James Francis from the Fourth, from the United States Magistrate Judge in the Southern District of New York since October of 1985. Judge Francis received his BA from Yale College in 1974, his JD degree from Yale Law School in 1978, and a master's degree in public policy from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, also in 1978. Following graduation from law school, Judge Francis clerked for the Honorable Robert L. Carter in the Southern District of New York. He then joined the Civil Appeals and Law Reform Unit of the Legal Aid Society, where he conducted impact litigation in the areas of housing and education, and served as director of the Disability Rights Unit. Judge Francis currently serves as an adjunct professor at the Fordham University School of Law, where he teaches constitutional torts. In the field of electronic data and the law, Judge Francis is the author of Roe Entertainment, Inc. versus William Morris Agency, which is a case involving procedures for electronic discovery and the allocation of costs, Convolve, Inc. v. Compact Computer Corp., concerning the obligation to preserve ephemeral data, Treple v. BioVail Corp., which deals with the standards for preservation orders for electronic data, Roselle v. Ross-Hulse, which discusses the relevance of emails to a claim of computer hacking, a second opinion in Treple, which deals with the remedies for spoliation of electronically stored information, and Richard Green, Fine Paintings v. McClendon, which permitted additional discovery and shifted costs as a consequence of the destruction of electronically stored information. And, of course, cost shifting is what we're talking about today. So glad to have you on the show, Judge Francis. We also have Megan Jones, who's a partner at Hossfeld LLP based in Washington, D.C. She concentrates on antitrust litigation and is a nationally recognized authority on electronic discovery. She's had a couple of interesting snippets in her background. One case where they had 1.5 million pages of documents produced by the opposing side, and she worked to identify 2,300 key documents in the case. So really shaved the case down and then deposed over 20 witnesses. Also, in the price-fixing area where she focuses, she's recovered half a billion dollars in those cases in aggregate. In e-discovery, she's a national expert, as we mentioned. She's a co-author of the Sedona Conference Glossary, e-discovery and digital management, second edition in 2007, and Navigating the Vendor Proposal Process, Best Practices for the Selection of Electronic Discovery Vendors, which is also published by the Sedona Conferences. And she often speaks all around the country on e-discovery issues and has had numerous publications. So thanks for coming on the show. And then the final panelist actually proposed the show to me back in New York a few weeks ago, or actually about 6 weeks ago, Robert Trenchard, who's a partner at WilmerHale, is the chair of WilmerHale's Litigation E-Discovery Committee, and also is the chair of the ABA Civil Litigation Subcommittee for International Litigation. He's a partner in the firm's litigation controversy department and a member of the business trial group. He joined the firm in 2003 and has maintained a litigation practice in New York for the past 13 years, where he's litigated civil and regulatory matters in federal and state courts and for regulatory agencies, including complex domestic and international contract disputes, antitrust matters, securities and commodities law, and regulation issues, insurance matters, torts, and telecommunication issues. And Bob, thanks for coming up with the topic. And of course, Judge Francis at Georgetown said this would be a topic he'd like to talk on. And so, and then we found a very knowledgeable, sophisticated plaintiff lawyer to join. So here we are. So why don't we jump into this topic? And first of all, I'd like to ask how people got interested in electronic discovery on their first show here. So Judge Francis, why don't we start with you, and then I'll ask Megan, and then Bob.
Well, thanks, Carl. My interest has arisen rather serendipitously. I've always had some interest in the intersection between law and science and technology, whether it's Daubert issues or patent cases or whatever, but I hadn't previously been involved in electronic discovery issues until back at the beginning of the drafting of the 2006 rules amendments. Judge Shindlin asked me if I would participate in a symposium that they were holding out in San Francisco to talk very generally about problems of electronic discovery and what might be done with the rules. And I followed through the rules amendment process, and at the same time, I was confronted with a case that presented issues of cost shifting in electronic discovery. And as you may know, if you as a judge author one opinion in a cutting edge area like electronic discovery, you are automatically deemed an expert. So at that point, I became much more heavily involved in electronic discovery issues, both in the opinion writing and also in talking at symposiums and attending symposiums and learning from my colleagues. So that's sort of my journey to this place.
And Megan, how about yourself?
I became involved with electronic discovery by necessity. As you mentioned, my practice is large, multi-party litigation, and about 10 years ago, the defendants that I was meeting with about their production started using these new words. Instead of boxes of documents, it was PDFs and TIFFs, and realizing that in order to prosecute cases on behalf of my clients, I was going to have to learn this information. And in the case that you mentioned at the beginning of the program, it was early enough in my career that it was one of the first cases where I was able to use some of the tools that were available rather than a linear review of 650 boxes of documents. And when you get to 550, you find the document that shapes your case theory and you have to go back to the beginning of the boxes and start over. I realized that this new technology can give you real-time answers, and realized that there were significant benefits to be had.
Well, great. And how about yourself, Bob?
Well, I grew up kind of surrounded by technology. My father was a CIO of a big multinational corporation, and my brother is now an internet entrepreneur, so I was always comfortable around technology. Although, as I like to tell my brother, I actually hate computers. But and so like Megan, you know, I was thrust into these cases in which, you know, antitrust matters and securities matters in particular involve sprawling discovery issues that, you know, can cover a huge swath of data that a company owns and involve many different systems, many different people, and you're by necessity forced into it. And that fact, combined with the fact that I was just generally comfortable with it, sort of led me here.
Well, let's sort of start into the topic of cost shifting, and why don't we start with the judge's perspective, Judge Francis. I guess we should possibly talk a little bit about Zubelake, or if you want to mention one of your other cases, and how cost shifting typically plays out in a case. You know, what are, you know, the parties' you know, responsibilities in federal court?
Sure. I think the first thing to keep in mind is that in federal court, the presumption is and has always been that the producing party bears its own costs in responding to a request for discovery, so that cause shifting is basically an exception to that rule, so that the where a producing party wants to shift the costs to the requesting party, it bears the burden of demonstrating that, that kind of exception is warranted. And under Zubelake and the other cost-shifting cases, the courts have developed a series of factors that they look to in order to determine whether cost-shifting is appropriate. And just to run down those, the factors that Zubelake identified were whether the discovery request is tailored to discover relevant information, whether the information may be available from other sources, what the cost of the discovery is relative to the amount in controversy, what the cost is relative to the parties' respective resources, what are the parties' relative abilities to control costs, what is the importance of the discovery to the issues in the litigation, and what are the benefits to the parties of the respective parties of obtaining the information that is sought. Now, Zubelake made clear that these factors aren't merely additive. That is, you don't say, well, there are four factors favoring cost shifting and three factors opposing it, so we're going to shift costs. As Judge Shindlin pointed out, these are not to be equally weighted. Her view was that, that the first two were the most important, but in any particular case, they may be weighted differently. For example, in some cases, a party may simply have no resources and be unable to bear the costs of discovery if they are shifted to that party. So that would be a dispositive factor in a case like that. In addition to weighing these factors, the courts will look at issues like which costs should be shifted. Are we talking about the costs of collection and production of data? Are we talking about the review costs, which can often outstrip all of the other costs? Which costs are we talking about? And also, courts need not shift costs in an all-or-nothing fashion. It may be that, as Judge Shindlin did in one of the Zubelake opinions, there may be a proportion of the costs that are shifted. For example, 25% of the costs of responding to a particular request might be shifted. So those are all considerations that the courts take into account. And it's also important to remember that in coming to the decision whether costs should be shifted, a court may engage in an iterative process. That is, it may ask the parties to engage in some subset of discovery, of the requested discovery, in order to ascertain the likelihood that relevant information is going to be produced and what the cost of producing it is going to be. So essentially, you'll engage in a test or an experiment to determine the appropriateness of shifting costs in the first place. So those are some of the issues that we confront from the judicial perspective.
Well, it sounds like this could vary depending on the parties and the type of the case, how the analysis runs. But let's look at the defense perspective first. Bob, how does this typically play out in a case for you on the defense side? Where do the costs commonly crop up and cause discomfort? When do you need to cry uncle?
Well, the costs crop up from our clients' perspectives, of course, at every stage of the process, beginning with preservation, continuing through collection, storage costs, vendor costs for storage, and higher and they're retaining acquiring software to review the material, actually conducting the review, which is where actually the biggest cost by far is, and then there are costs associated directly with production. And, you know, consistent with what Judge Francis was talking about, the costs, certainly from putting aside review for just one second, from the mechanics of collecting the information, do go up quite substantially when you're talking about what the federal rules talk about as inaccessible data. Now, that is a vague or broad term, I would say, and it is probably a shifting term, depending on, you know, as technology develops. So things like backup tapes may once have been inaccessible, and these days you can have archive systems that are no longer inaccessible. You can have deleted data that's inaccessible, or maybe it's accessible, depending on the software that's available to the client. But they really do crop up at every stage. By far, the biggest cost to the client is review. It is the, I don't know, it could be 70, 80, 90% of the total costs. And there are some things that have been done recently to help with those costs, Rule 502, and its embrace of, you know, quick peek and clawbacks, same with, as well as Rule 26 in the federal system, are designed to help with that, but they only go so far. And at the end of the day, the fundamental problem is that the volume of data continues to increase because it's so easy to create. And that's, you know, the cost and the benefit, the cost of having the benefit of all this wonderful technology that our clients use to run their businesses. And obviously when those businesses get caught up in litigation, all that stuff matters.
So I'm hearing a lot of pain. Megan, on the plaintiff side, how does disparate ESI tend to impact you and your client?
Well, I think negatively, it is definitely requiring more time and analysis at the beginning of a case. So instead of starting discovery within 3 months of filing, necessarily meet and confers are taking place about what ESI exists, what format it is in, and the availability. It's a much slower route to starting discovery. Positively, I think, as Bob mentioned, vendors are stepping up and delivering solutions that are cost-effective. We are using technology to search technology. The backup tapes is a great example. In 2000, it was full stop. If it was on a backup tape, it was usually cost prohibitive. And now, in a case this year, I restored 60 backup tapes for $14,000. It's just the vendors are filling the space and stepping up, which I think is great. I also think more practitioners are getting it and realizing that, excuse me, ESI is here to stay, and they're becoming more educated. And if they refuse to become educated, they're at least bringing someone to the meetings that is. I think the new frontier here will be the Sedona Conference's Cooperation Proclamation. It's a valiant effort to solve a very difficult problem. What will be determined is if people accept the new playbook. I think in some of the meet and confers that I conduct and have conducted in 2010, saying, okay, before I do my document request, let me talk to you about what business units may have relevant data, what custodians are likely to have responsive data. I am still in 2010 met with counsel's response, go serve your document request, and then I'm going to object. You know, some counsel really are not in favor of having these informal discussions, which can benefit them. As a plaintiff's lawyer, if I know that a business unit doesn't have responsive documents, of course I'm going to agree that you don't have to search those documents. That's in my benefit because I don't want irrelevant documents or data that I then have to pay to store and review. I think a best practice for counsel out there is to memorialize those efforts about how a party has tried to get to the specific discovery request that Judge Francis mentioned at the beginning of the program. And if counsel aren't willing to participate, it's something to make a record of. But I think that's gonna be the interesting frontier in the next 10 years is to see, you know, what playbook counsel use in discovery.
So on the plaintiff's side, is someone that has studied this area and worked and written and has a very impressive background, do you see more active cooperation to try to reduce the burden to a fair burden on the corporate defendant as being something that's, you know, in your interests, or is it still it's your costs. I'm sorry.
I think that there is definitely room to negotiate about where documents and data live and what is relevant. I think it's on both. I think it's beneficial to both sides to have that conversation.
And from what I've seen on my side, I agree with Megan. It is generally beneficial. There is something that's alluded to, and that was alluded to in your intro about, you know, the asymmetry of the parties and how that plays into the negotiations, which is quite important. You know, in company on company litigation, which is relatively symmetrical, that is, you've got, you know, relatively same size companies that have relatively similar electronic discovery burdens, there's, you know, the negotiation tends to proceed along a different path than if you have asymmetrical parties where one side has got really very minimal stuff that it can collect and produce and the other side has got tons. And it's as you'd expect. And, you know, one of the hardest questions in cost shifting and generally policing this process more broadly is how you deal with that situation. Because in that situation, you know, cooperation works and it goes, but it only goes so far. And that I agree with, Megan, is going to be the interesting thing to watch as it unfolds over the next 10 years.
Now, I heard Megan express a great willingness to negotiate over the scope of the search and things of that nature. I'm not sure I heard a willingness to share in the costs of production. Am I reading too much into that, Megan?
You're not. You are correct.
Yeah, I wasn't hearing a fight there yet either. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, what I'm trying to understand is it seems like cooperation is a solution to reducing the motions for cost shifting, but you're hearing these motions, Judge Francis, correct? So when do you typically hear these types of motions, and do you prefer the parties work these issues out before coming to you?
Well, I always prefer that they work them out, but I also recognize that while I can bring the counsel to the conference table, I can't make them agree. So we will ultimately get some number of motions, and I appreciate that there are going to be issues that are just not going to be resolvable without a motion. But I am heartened by the fact that there does appear to be much more cooperation among counsel, primarily, as Megan suggests, along the lines of negotiating what custodians to look to, what the nature of the search protocol is going to be, agreement on keywords, and so forth. I have also seen agreements with respect to sharing of costs, where the parties have recognized that there is a substantial burden involved in responding to a particular request, and rather than subject themselves to the uncertainty of my decision, they will reduce their risks by agreeing on an allocation of costs between them. And I think that's very wise, because once they come to the court, they are putting their interests at risk, because the court is ultimately going to have less information about the case than counsel and their clients are going to have, and the decision is inevitably going to be more arbitrary than the agreement that counsel could come to.
I'm going to ask a general question that sort of occurred to me as I listened to this dialogue. Would it be fair to say that most cost-shifting scenarios emerge from having counsel on one side or on the other who are less educated about how e-discovery works in practice? Understanding early on, everyone was less educated, okay? But now that we have the cooperation proclamation out there, is it almost an asymmetrical skill an issue in causing cost shifting to become an issue?
Well, I think, you know, look, if as counsel you go into a situation, and having been there, done that a number of times, you see the cost train rolling towards you, yeah, you're almost by definition more equipped to talk about it with the other side. And I agree with Judge Francis that there are, I've seen agreements too to share the burdens of going out and preserving and collecting and producing certain data. Those burdens, those costs tend to be costs as opposed to fees, of course. And that's important because, you know, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the lion's share of the total economic cost to our clients actually come from the review costs from having attorneys go through documents looking for privilege and responses and that sort of thing. But nonetheless, there are definitely instances that I'm aware of where you have a plaintiff who wants, you know, to get access to deleted data on this or that hard drive, and since deleted data is usually deemed inaccessible, they are often willing to pay for it without having to go and fight in front of someone like Judge Francis over it, and that's great.
You know, Megan, you mentioned there are new technologies out there, and you've been embracing some of them. The backup tape example is a great example. Do you see this even going into the area? Maybe this is a hypothetical, but with concept searching to almost work with the other side to say, yes, we're willing to try some new techniques to find data, you know, less expensively and quicker?
I do, and I think that personally, I am willing to try cost-effective and efficient methods of searching with a caveat, which is, you know, I'm willing to agree to use this new technology, but there has to be some protection if it's later deemed ineffective. What usually happens in these meet and confers is I want to try this new technology, and plaintiffs, I'd like you to sign here on the dotted line that once we do it, this is all you're ever going to ask for because we don't want to go back and do it twice. Well, that kind of chills the introduction of new technology. And so I think another practice point would be, you know, if a defendant or a plaintiff wants to introduce a new cost-effective technology, is to agree to the caveat, which is, let's try it, and build in a safety net where if it doesn't work, we can come up with something else.
And interestingly, on that point, you know, one way to square that circle is to make liberal use of something Judge Francis referred to when he was describing Zubelik and the general approach in the federal system, which is the use of sampling. You can use a new whatever the new technology, whatever the magic box is that you use to separate the relevant stuff from the irrelevant stuff and the privileged from the non-privileged stuff. It almost doesn't matter how it works as long as you use a statistically sound method of testing the results. And so if you go about it that way, you don't even have to get the other side to agree. I mean, you can give them a heads up saying, by the way, this is how we're doing it. You know, we're using this, that, or the other magic box to separate the important stuff from the unimportant stuff. But where the rubber hits the road is that, you know, if there's ultimately a fight, and hopefully there wouldn't be, you know, the folks in Judge Francis's position don't have to necessarily understand the often extraordinarily complicated mathematics that lie within some of these tools. Instead, all they need is some much more basic statistical knowledge, which can be provided by an expert, that shows how statistically the results are sound.
I'm certainly glad to hear that I don't have to understand mathematics. but I think, Bob, you really hit the nail on the head. From the judicial perspective, we're concerned about whether or not the whatever the technique is adequately validated. We have a comfort level with word searches and that kind of thing because we use them all the time. We have much less of a comfort level with concept searching. In lots of instances, the algorithms, even if we could understand them, are proprietary, and they're not going to be shared with us in any event. So it is important to have some kind of comfort level, and I think the suggestion that they be validated statistically is terrific. Now, I guess my question would be, can you do that in a way that's cost-effective so that you're not spending more validating your search technique than you would by simply using a different search technique?
You know, and certainly speaking from the defense perspective, the answer is yes, although the extent to which it's cost-effective is related, of course, to the size of the production and its complexity. But certainly in our experience, you can use statistics to very substantially cut down the overall cost. Because, you know, you take a small sample and you apply what's called a zero defect test to the stuff, for instance, that's been searched and is left over and is deemed after your search to be not relevant. And, you know, a statistician tells you, look, you searched through 500 documents here of this 100,000 pile of 100,000. And if you find nothing in that 500 that's responsive, then we as statisticians can certify that that pile of 100,000 documents is 99% free of responsive stuff.
Then, Bob, do you even have to go to Megan and talk to her about this? If you're comfortable, it's defensible from a statistical background, can you just go ahead and do it? We're handling our discovery.
You can. There are obviously risks in that. And
well, the major risk is that you're going to run into a judge who is not comfortable with the statistical analysis.
Right.
And that, I think, is a problem. I mean, if a judge is going to require 100% eyeballing of a production in order to say that you've done an adequate review, otherwise you're going to be faced with a possibility of waiver of privilege or something like that, then you've got a problem. And I think it's to some extent the ball is in the judge's court to appreciate the need for use of advanced technologies and for understanding that so much of this is going to be driven by probabilities and the probability of one document being overlooked or a privileged document being produced may be so small as to be insignificant, and we have to accept that that's going to happen even in a completely legitimate production.
So Judge Francis, you raise a real interesting point here about being comfortable as the judge at the end of the day, that it is defensible. How do judges get knowledgeable about this area, since they're typically not in the document review room and they're typically not seeing the tools that are being used, yet everyone talks about the high cost associated with the current linear review and overbroad keywords?
Well,
I mean, it's complicated.
It is, and apart from attending CLEs and things like that, the only way the judge can get it is really from the parties. Counsel have to be prepared to come in and make the presentation with respect to the reliability of their search tools or the appropriateness of their search protocols so that we're educated in that case. Now, hopefully that education will serve us in other cases as well, but most of what we learn comes case by case.
Yeah, and Carly, you know, that it clearly is, you know, counsel's responsibility to educate judges to the extent that they need it about, first off, really something that Judge Francis hit on, which is very important, which is the impossibility of perfection.
Sure.
You know, and then secondly, the reliability of the process that you've actually used.
So then would you suggest, I mean, Megan, do you like to be involved in this dialogue if possible so that you can then tell people and write, this works as a solution?
There's definitely a strategic advantage when the parties discuss what's relevant. You would hate to think that a defendant designed this wonderful search technology thinking it knows what plaintiffs want when, in fact, plaintiffs want another set of material. So by not having that conversation, there certainly is a risk that we say, this is wonderful, but we'd also like this. So if you have a conversation before the search is run, you can kind of avoid that area. Unfortunately, litigators are litigious, and this will just be another area where we gain a new skill set, which is how much does it really cost to get data from these sources? You know, what is reliability? What is defensible? I think these are going to be new areas where, unfortunately, litigators litigate. And more unfortunately for judges, because we're going to bring this to you when we can't agree. But I think, you know, that's another area that, you know, in the old days, it was, did you shred it or not? And it was a rather binary decision, does paper exist or not? And now the game has changed so much. I think it's just the new way to litigate and handle these cases.
Well, I think that's it. It's not just that lawyers are litigious. It's that it's a completely new paradigm. It was never the situation before that you would have discussions about where you were going to search in the same kind of depth that you have to have when you're talking about ESI.
Right, and you know, there are emerging standards. The Victor Stanley case, Judge Grimm talks about what is a reasonable review process for purposes of protecting the privilege, and you know that's a model. I mean, he actively embraces the use of statistics, by the way, in that analysis. The Sedona conference has got a whole group of folks who are talking about the use of statistics and you know what level of perfection is expected. There's a number of studies out there that you know show that, or suggest anyway, that you know human review is actually much more fallible than some of the statistical tools that we can use these days. And that's a process of you know educating folks. You know, when people grew up in law firms 20, 30 years ago, they wanted to have eyeballs on a page so that if someone messed up, they could yell at them. And that's kind of the model they grew up with, and the assumption there was that was the best way to have a high quality production, and the fact is that you know that model only gets you to a certain point, but there's just human error in the process when you've got armies of staff and contract attorneys 20, 30, 100 strong. You can't get them all marching in the same direction, and the different human beings, different minds, are going to have different judgments about the very same document and its responsiveness to a request, and that leads to just some inevitable error rate, and the question is how you control for that.
Especially when you're in the middle of a fight.
Right.
You know?
That's right.
It's a laboratory,
that's right.
It's a fight. So.
That's right, and it gets even more intense when your adversary is the government. I represent a lot of regulated entities, and when the government is knocking on your door, you know, that process moves blazingly fast as compared to civil litigation.
So I almost feel I should have called this topic cost shifting by trying new technology.
Well, you know, this picks up, this all circles back to something Megan said at the very beginning, which is the market is responding. The market is responding to costs. The challenge is that there will be a point of diminishing returns where, you know, new technologies can only alleviate the costs to a certain point. And then the question becomes a policy question of, you know, do you shift costs or not, and in what context do you do it? And, you know, obviously Judge Francis described the Zuber-like factors in the federal system. You know, different courts may go about it a different way.
Yeah, let's talk about the article you wrote a few years ago, Two Roads Diverge in Managing E-Discovery Costs, in the New York Law Journal, which highlights that at least some courts in New York put the burden on the plaintiffs to pay for any discovery they request. And do you see this as a system worth exploring as a solution? Or?
Well, I mean, the point of the article, it was, I think, in November of last year, and the point of the article was there seems to be an interesting experiment developing. On the one hand, you have a federal system in which, as Judge Francis described, the presumption is that each party bears its own costs. There can be cost shifting in the right contexts, but the presumption is that everyone bears their own costs. But, you know, in the post-Twombly-Nickbull world, and Twombly expressly talks about the cost of discovery as a reason for its change to the pleading standards, you have a higher pleading burden. And so the mix there is, you know, takes more to get in the door, but once you're in the door, the costs are borne by the parties. And the New York system, the state courts have not adopted the Twombly-Iqbal model. They kind of still follow the old Conley v. Gibson model of pleading. So the ability to get into the court system is arguably easier in New York State. But as you said, there are some cases that interpret the CPLR, that's New York's Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, to have a presumption that's the reverse of what Judge Francis described, which is that the requesting party bears the costs of discovery. There are decisions going the other way in classic New York State fashion, but there are decisions that suggest that the requesting party should bear the costs. And there's even some, there's even one case, a case called T.A. Ahern, which says that within the definition of cost is not just what we normally would think of as cost, but includes, you know, review the fees of the people who have to review the stuff for privilege and responsiveness, which is quite a ruling. And the point of the article was, here's an interesting sort of Brandeisian experiment where you've got two different systems that have different rules for getting in the door and then different rules for, you know, the costs of doing business once you're in the building. And, you know, what's going to be the effect? And it really raised a question, which is an empirical one. The trade-offs, obviously, we are dealing with are a combination of access to justice, the search for truth, and the efficiency of the system. And you're trading off all of those things against one another. And here we have maybe, and again, the New York system is, you know, it's debatable whether there is this presumption. But assuming there is, you've got these two systems. And wouldn't it be interesting if someone could come up with a way of studying empirically the output of those systems in light of those, you know, competing values of access to justice, the search for truth, and the efficiency of the system?
Megan, do you find that analysis interesting? Typically, you have less resources than the defendant.
I do. I wonder, you know, CPLR, the local rule 3120, was adopted 40 years ago when ECI was but a glimmer in our imagination. I wonder if this is a policy choice or a square peg and round hole kind of issue, which is, this is the rule we have, let's make it work. There definitely are some policy pieces coming out of that court that are putting it into issue whether it's something that they want to pursue. I would just say that, you know, our system of justice has never been premised on how much truth you can afford, and I hope that that remains the case. We did try this system of no discovery or limited discovery prior to the 1930s enactment of the federal rules, and it wasn't desirable. We had trials that clogged the courts for months when the discovery wasn't conducted at trial in front of the judge, where, you know, 60 to 70% of court days were used for trials. We had gotcha revelations of evidence that if they had been revealed earlier in the process, that may have driven settlement and dismissed the case. So I think, you know, defendants in one action should be mindful that they may be plaintiffs in another. And I hope zealous advocates realize the effect of their positions for clients of the future. I think the law is heading in the right direction with the cooperation proclamation, early case assessment, and the arrival of new technology to help these defendants deal with the rising costs of preservation and collection and production, which plaintiffs are facing as well.
A lot of the distinction between the federal model and the New York State model is going to depend on how forceful the courts consider the presumption to be. If the presumption is easily overcome, then the models look a lot more similar. If it's hard to overcome, then the distinction between them becomes much greater. And I think that's another issue that, you know, would be looked at in some kind of empirical study.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right, Judge Francis. I think that, you know, and you'd also have to, I mean, it may be the case that an empirical study isn't possible right now because of the uncertainty in New York law. On first off, as to whether there is such a presumption, and secondly, as to its strength. But it does, you know, raise interesting questions about the relationship between pleading standards and discovery burdens. And, I mean, it's very clear that the Supreme Court in Twombly, in particular, was very concerned about the cost of discovery in modern antitrust litigation, and that was a heavy consideration in how they ultimately came out with respect to the pleading standards. And, you know, Megan is absolutely right about the trade-offs, and she's absolutely right that defendants in one case are plaintiffs in another case. And, you know, it's a very thorny policy question. And that was really the only point in the article, which is, wouldn't it be nice if we could figure out a way to actually test the various ways of attacking the problem? And it's hard to do. It's very difficult to do.
And, we've talked about costs thus far in the context of a single case. Judge Francis, one item, and everyone talks about costs, but do you think it's fair for a defendant who might have dozens to hundreds of cases, if they're large, to focus on the overall costs in front of you in the context of a single case?
Oh, I'm going to tell them that's irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. The mere fact that they are large and therefore are likely to face a lot of litigations is not an argument to me to be made to me in a particular case as to the appropriateness of cost shifting. I'm more interested in what's the marginal value of the discovery that's requested in this case, and should I be shifting costs? I'm sure that Megan would say that it would be unfair for her to be the victim of one of my cost-shifting orders merely because she's opposing a very large defendant who has lots of other litigations.
Although it is sort of related to the Zubelake test of not having resources. If so many resources are being spent, I guess that's one of the concerns that a lot of corporate defendants have, is they're spending so much on discovery across the board. Anyway, it's a subject for another podcast. I figured I'd just throw it out there.
So. I mean, on that, just on that issue, what often happens is, and this is really on counsel to explain to the court and try to persuade the court, and if you can't, you can't. Larger companies, these days in particular, more and more have got teams of people devoted internally to this issue, really. You have in-house people from the House Counsel, people from IT, paralegals, all sorts of folks. That said, there's a limited pool of those resources, even for large companies. And that sometimes can be a relevant fact for purposes of evaluating the costs and benefits and the proportionality of responding to various requests. That's something, at least in my experience, some judges will listen to, which is, look, we have only a certain amount of resources. We can't do this, that, or the other thing unless the other side pays for somebody else to come in and be devoted to their case. And I've seen that happen.
Oh, I think that's a fair point. No, mm-hmm. It's not just the costs of outside vendors that get factored into cost shifting analysis. It's also the resources that the party is devoting to collecting and producing the data. I certainly agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been an interesting discussion, going from cost shifting into, I think the common theme has been cost cooperation and trying to figure out ways to deal with the cost better. I appreciate the three of you joining us and having this dialogue. So I want to thank Judge Francis, Megan, and Bob for joining us on an ESI Bites program. Hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later in the year. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our shows. You can also remember our show and website phonetically. It sounds out as Easy Bites. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bites to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov, wishing you a nice day. Sorry, I have a defective mouse here for ending the show.